This is work I've been doing in Harvard in collaboration with Johannes Bauer and Dibanjan Chowdhury and Subir Sachdev. And so this talk is about this new entry in the phase diagram of the cuprates, this observation of charge correlations in underdoped cuprates. And the goal of this talk is to first tell you that we sort of understand relatively well where this phenomenon comes from. And what are, and we also understand what are many of its phenomenological implications. So I'll start by giving you a quick review of the experimental evidence that we have for this phenomenon. And then I'll try to derive it from a simple model as a consequence of a simple model. And then I'll describe some phenomenological implications of it, and especially focus on quantum oscillations. So what are cuprate superconductors? Well, they are layered materials in which most of the physics happens in this two-dimensional lattice made of copper and oxygen. And the intrinsic material has one electron per unit cell, so one should expect it to be a metallic conductor, but instead is insulating, and this is because of effects of Coulomb repulsion. So electrons on this lattice cannot hop from side to side because they are repelled by some other electrons sitting here, and they're not able to delocalize. And this insulating state has long-range antiferromagnetic order. But however, if you dope the material and introduce some holes in this plane, then these holes are free to move around, and they quickly disrupt this long-range antiferromagnetic order, and the material becomes a bad metal, a conductor. Not only, but if you lower the temperature sufficiently, it also becomes superconducting. And it becomes superconducting at relatively high temperatures of order 100 kelvins, so much higher than most other materials. And this was the story until some time ago. Now we know that there's extra phenomena happening in this phase diagram. And in particular, I'm going to focus on this observation of the fact that there are charge correlations in this region of doping. So what I'm showing here is the phase diagram of cuprates. We have whole doping in the layer versus temperature. And here we have this antiferromagnetic domain, this superconducting state. And within here, there have been observation of at least short-range charge density wave correlations. Now, this charge density wave correlation are enhanced and possibly become long-range if you turn on a large magnetic field. And this is an indication that this is a state that is competing with superconductivity. So let me now describe a few of the probes that give us indication that this order is there. And one of the first indications came from the study of quantum oscillation. So as you know, in a metal, typically most several thermodynamic and transport quantities oscillate periodically in 1 over B as you increase the magnetic field. And the frequency of oscillations is basically set by the area in momentum space of the Fermi surface of the metal. And here I'm showing quantum oscillations from two different doping levels. These are actually two slightly different materials, but believed to be, well, both of them are cuprate superconductors. And we see that at large doping, I have this very fast oscillation frequency that corresponds to a large area in momentum space. This area is roughly 2/3 of the Brillouin zone. But if you move to low doping, I have this much lower oscillation frequency that corresponds to some pocket in momentum space, which has an area of only roughly 2% of the Brillouin zone. So there is some dramatic change in the electronic properties of the material as you change the doping. And this change can be explained, and I will delve into details of how this can be explained by the presence of this charge density wave here. But moving to an other related experiment that gives us this indication is the measurement of the whole conductivity, which as you lower temperature in this low doping region, it changes from being positive to being negative, which means that the transport is, which at high temperature is carried by positively charged carriers, which is what we would expect since we have doped the copper oxygen plane with holes. The transport changes and it becomes dominantly carried by negative charge carriers. And this can also be brought about by a charge density wave in a way that I will describe later. Then there are more direct proofs, more direct indication of this phenomenon. And they come from SDM and from resonant X-ray scattering. So here I'm showing a Fourier transform tunneling amplitude of an STM experiment. And you can see, so basically this is momentum space, and you can see this peak at non-zero momentum. And they correspond, or at least they are associated with some periodic modulation of the local charge density. And the same is true for resonant X-ray. This is data that is taking a scan along this direction here. And you see this peak at non-zero momentum again, which tells us that there is some static correlation with that wave vector. And in this picture here, the copper-oxygen bonds lie diagonally in this direction. So this experiment tells us also that the wave vector of the charge density wave is always parallel to the copper-oxygen bonds. And it has some value, which is roughly around 0.3. So it's an incommensurate charge density wave. And okay, this charge density wave also has some non-trivial internal intra-unit cell structure. So what do I mean by that? So let's consider, in addition to the expectation value of C-Dagger-C that would be modulated in a conventional typical charge density wave, we can also consider the expectation value of C-Dagger-C across as a bond between two sides like this. And this can also have periodic modulations over space. So this is what I'm indicating with this cosine factor. And a typical what's called S waveform factor would be trivial in this sense that if I look at a specific point on the lattice, I will have some either excess, which I represent in this diagram with red color, or some lack of charge. And then this local uniform pattern is modulated with a wave vector Q. But I can have also a less trivial local pattern. So here, if I look at one single site, the bonds around it have either excess or lack of charge, depending on whether they are horizontal or vertical. So this bond here is red, so it has some excess charge, and this is blue, it has some lack of charge, and then some excess and some lack. So we have this plus minus pattern. And then this pattern is then modulated with an overall waveform, with an overall form of a cosine. This is what's called a D-wave, charge density wave. And this is what we believe is actually realized in the cuprates. So there have been several experiments to probe this. And particularly, if you were there this morning, we had a talk by Shimus that explained us how they were able to directly prove this kind of pattern. It's a very nice experiment. It's very direct, but it's kind of lengthy to explain, so I don't have the time to go into the details of it right now. But anyway, like by now, it's quite clear that this is the local pattern of the charge density. So these are the phenomenological features that we have. We have an incommensurate charge density wave with a wave vector parallel to the copper-oxygen bond and with a local D-wave pattern. So can we get these features from a simple model of the material? So the model that of choice for studying the copper-oxygen plane is the TJV model. So this is a model of electrons that hop on a square lattice, and they can interact via nearest neighbor spin exchange interaction and via nearest neighbor Coulomb repulsion. And also we have to include the fact that electrons cannot hop on the same site because of this strong Coulomb repulsion that is a leftover from the MOT insulating phase that I was describing before. So we have this constraint that no two electrons can occupy any physical state. And from this model, we want to see if naturally there is an instability to getting an expectation value to this bond order that is modulated over space. So this problem has been studied for a while without taking into account this constraint. So just a simple antiferromagnetic metal. Well, simple, just an interacting antiferromagnetic metal. And what's being found is that besides being unstable to BCS superconductivity, it's being unstable to D-wave superconductivity, it's also unstable to the formation of D-wave charge density wave. And this D-wave charge density wave has a wave vector Q that is fixed by geometric properties of the Fermi surface. In particular, it's always found to connect two points on the Fermi surface, which are typically called hotspots. These are points on the Fermi surface that are connected by the antiferromagnetic wave vector. And these are points on the Fermi surface that most strongly feel the antiferromagnetic interaction, and those are that participate more strongly in the instability. However, in all models with only antiferromagnetic exchange, the CDW that comes out always have the wave vector along the diagonal, not parallel to the copper oxygen bond. So this is a shortcoming of this model. And the so what we have been trying to do is to see whether the inclusion of correlation, the inclusion of Coulomb repulsion, can modify the picture and give us a wave a CDW with a wave vector closer to what it's in an experiment. So how do we include correlations? Well, we have to take some numerical procedure, and the procedure we follow is variational Monte Carlo. So it means that we are going to sample real space configurations of the electrons on the lattice. And we are going to sample them according to the weight, to this weight, which is basically the overlap of our configuration with the ground state of some free fermionic Hamiltonian. And we are going to take this state as a variational state. So we're going to optimize the energy of the model Hamiltonian with respect to all possible states. And then as we hop from configuration to configuration, we never hop onto a configuration which two electrons occupy the same side. And in this way, we implement the constraint of no double occupancy. So we have to choose what state, what variational space to put in here. So we have to choose a variational space that is big enough to contain a suitable number of possibilities so that we are not just telling the system what we want it to do, but we want the system to tell us what it wants to do. So this is the variational space that we take. We take a variational Hamiltonian which has some hopping and some overall charge modulation. And both the wave vector and the amplitude of that I indicate with this phi of the modulation on every bond are variational parameters. And if, well, we minimize the energy, we find that any of these phi of A's gains a non-zero value. So we get a better energy by giving a finite value to one of these phi of A. This means that the system wants to develop a charge density wave with a certain form factor. And the precise form factor will be given by what phi of A's will get at the end of our minimization procedure. So what is the outcome of this procedure? Well, we can describe it by looking at this diagram. So what I'm showing here is the space of wave vectors. These are variational parameters. So it's the QX and QY of the CDW. And I'm showing it for two different Fermi surface geometries. And wherever you see a darker spot, it means that you can actually gain some energy by condensing a CDW at that wave vector Q. And also, this is a statistical procedure, so you can see some noise in other places. So in particular, there are like three spots where we can have a CDW, one here, one here, and one here. What this diagram doesn't tell you, but what I'm going to tell you now, is what form factor does the CDW have here. And it turns out that these two spots here have a D-wave form factor, whereas this other point here is not exactly a CDW, but it's still a state within that can be represented within the variational space that we chose. It's what's called a stagger flux. It's a state that breaks time reversal symmetry spontaneously. And it supports this pattern of permanent current. And so this is also a relatively good variational state. But more importantly, we have these two CDWs. And in this particular setup, we have that a CDW with wave vector with the wave form factor and wave vector parallel to the copper oxygen bond is the globally stable minimum, which means that it's the leading instability after superconductivity in this setup. Then we can do a larger search another fact that I would like to point out is that the wave vector at which the instability wants to develop is very close to the wave vector one would predict from just looking at the location of hotspots. So if I change the geometry of the Fermi surface, the hotspots move around, and the minimum that we found also tracks the hotspot. Then we can do an exploration of the parameter space of the material. So as a function of the spin exchange and Coulomb repulsion, we can look what is the global minimum in energy. And so we have possible realization of all three states that I described. So we can have stagger flux, we can have one kind of CDW with one with wave vector parallel to the copper oxygen and the other kind of CDW. And so we have a model in which we can get the CDW that with all the features that are seen in experiments in a relatively natural way. There is a relatively wide space in which this happens. And for this result, it was absolutely necessary to include correlations. And it's not something that comes out of just a simple antiferromagnetic method. Yep.
So in this case, you don't include the pairing in the analysis. There's no other parameter for the pairing, the D-wave pairing.
You mean superconducting?
Yeah.
Yeah, you could add it in the variational space. In that case, it would become the leading instability, right? But we also know that it's superconductivity is a strong, it's long range and strong in the material, right? But we want to see what other states does the copper oxygen plane want to go to besides that. So we close that channel because we know it's there, we know it's important, but we want to see what other channels you can flow into.
But how about the interplay between these?
The interplay between T means that you have to basically double your variational space, and it becomes harder, you know, more parameters to minimize. So we haven't done the computation, and this was already an extremely intense computation. It took several thousand of CPU days. So I don't think it, at least I don't want to do the more general computation. Okay, so I hope I convince you that we rather know where these CDW correlations come from. So let me now move to.
Question.
Yep.
So at a microscopic level, though, where is the energy saved in the Hamiltonian?
You want some intuitive picture for why this state is a good state?
You know, in a pyro CDW, you can save the Coulomb energy directly by distorting the crystal. But this thing, there's actually no net charge modulation. In each unit cell, there's no net charge. So I find it a little bit difficult to intuitively understand where the energy saving comes from.
Well, I'm going to say I find it equally difficult. It's not something that I have an answer right away.
But since you started with the TJV model, maybe energy is so stored in J, super exchange correlation is more in some region and less related to like some kind of singlet ordering.
I would say the reason it's complicated, it involves J,
and
it involves Coulomb, and it involves the Fermi surface, and you can't throw out either of those three. You throw one on the other, then you get different pictures.
Yeah, this is something that's slightly non-satisfactory about the picture. It's not a completely generic phenomenon. You tune the Fermi surface geometry, and the best state changes. You tune one of the parameters, and it changes. So, yeah.
So if you take a step back from your beautiful observations here, this state has never been observed before in solid state physics. Okay, this is a new state. Okay, and there is some fundamental reason why it exists, okay? And people would like to know what that reason is, okay? So maybe we should turn some attention to that subject.
Okay, I'll take it as a research advice, okay.
I have two questions. One, are the parameters physically reasonable?
Well,
T's that you get out, do they sort of match what we'd expect for the Q-breaks?
Okay, the parameter we had to crank a little bit beyond what's expected is this nearest neighbor Coulomb repulsion in order to stabilize this order. So yeah, I would claim that that's probably a limitation of what we are doing. But you know, the question it was already I think a big step to have this state as being an actual minimum, right? And then. Whether we can, you know, find a better phenomenological model that is in better connection with, I don't know, with spectroscopic hoppings that you will get from spectroscopy, that's a further step, I would say.
The other question is, have you tried including spin density wave order, which occurs in some family of Q-breaks, as well as charge order?
I have not, and this goes back to enlarging the variational parameter space.
I mean, another thing worth mentioning is that the other competing methods are DMRG or these PEPs, people doing numerical. And those are, they have different advantages and disadvantages. They have the disadvantage of being a smaller system size, they are effectively infinite here. And also, those methods systematically have a bias against any sort of Fermi surface. So they just don't appear in those methods very naturally at all.
Okay.
So if you want to do any honest job of the Fermi surface, this is it. It's hard. No one's done better, really.
All right, so let me move to the second part of this talk, where I'm going to describe some implications of this, the presence of this order in the phenomenology of quantum oscillations. But so quantum oscillations are a manifestation of Landau quantization of energy levels, and I'm sure that you are all very familiar with it, but I'm going to have to do this quantization in a messy setup where I have some non-commensurate charge density waves. So I would like to review rapidly how it can be derived in a semi-classical approach. So I'm going to start with a translational invariant Hamiltonian with a background magnetic field, which I represent with this vector potential A. And I want to study its energy level at the semi-classical level. So I will create a wave packet here, which is almost a momentum eigenstate, but it has a finite extent in position space. It has a Gaussian envelope, and it's center a certain position r. And I'm going to allow this state to depend on time only through the time dependence of k and r. And I'm going to derive an effective action for k and r by plugging in this state into this action here. So you see that if psi was the most general state, then by doing variation, I would just get back Schrodinger equation. But instead, I will just do variations within this manifold of states, and I'll get an effective field theory that best approximate the Schrodinger equation within this manifold of states. And if I do that, this is the effective action that I get. It's a phase-space action, so it has the form of like pq dot minus h, where h is the Hamiltonian. So it's k and r are obviously canonically conjugate to each other, and the dispersion on the lattice plays the role of a Hamiltonian, and it's a function of this combination, k minus a. So you see, obviously, that k minus a plays a very important role. So what I would like to do is I would like to make a change of canonical variable so that this thing I call p, which is k minus a, is the new variable in which I'm studying the system. And I can do that because, pz, if the magnetic field is constant and pointing along the z direction, then pz is conserved. And px and py are conjugate to each other. And there's also another pair of canonically conjugate variables, x and p, which commute with px and py. But I'm not writing them down because they depend on your choice of gauge. But this allows me to do a change of variable and move to this other effective action here, where we have the pair px, py dot. We have pzz, which is just, pz is just conserved. We have this set of complementary variables, which just decouples, is what's going to give you the degeneracy of the Landau levels, and then we have the dispersion. And in these coordinates, it's kind of obvious at the classical level what the system wants to do. We have this pxpy particle that wants to describe constant energy, so constant epsilon orbits. So I'm drawing one of them here. So pz has to be constant, and I draw a section of px and py, and this analog pxpy particles wants to go around one of these orbit here. Whenever this particle goes around a closed orbit, we can re-quantize back the system using Bohr-Sommerfeld quantization and impose that the total action around the orbit is an integer multiple of 2 pi. So this is the Bohr-Sommerfeld quantization condition. But if you look at it, this is nothing but the area enclosed by one of these orbits here. So what we have is that we have an energy level in the original Hamiltonian whenever the area of an enclosed orbit is an integer multiple of 2 pi n b. And this is what gives me the energy of Landau levels. Basically, it's the energy at which the area enclosed by the constant energy contour is an integer multiple of 2 pi n b. And now let me introduce back pz. Let's look at the three-dimensional picture. So the three-dimensional picture is this onion-like shape where if I take any cross-section of this thing, it is formed by contours that enclose a quantized area. And What I'm showing here, I'm showing only those contours that whose energy is less than the Fermi level. So this means that the envelope of this onion is just the Fermi surface. And the edges of each one of the rings of the onion is a finite contribution to the density of states at the Fermi level. This is because this is a contour which has the energy equal to the Fermi level, and it contains an integer multiple of 2 pi nb. So this means that to each one of these contours, there corresponds a Landau level that is exactly at the Fermi level. So the sum of all these of these edges gives you basically the density of states at the Fermi level. Now, what happens is that if I crank up the magnetic field, well, each one of these shells has to contain a slightly larger amount of flux, so they get pushed out. They get pushed out until the outermost touches this extremal area and then disappears. In the moment in which it touches this extremal area, these two edges touch together and they are tangential to the Fermi surface, so there is a extra contribution or like a peak in the density of state. So it's kind of intuitively clear that as I increase B, the density of state will have periodic fluctuation whenever one of these two edges meet and then disappear. And this is actually what one can compute explicitly, get this expression where you see that the density of states at the Fermi level or at any frequency is a periodic function of 1 over B. And now, since most things in a metal are either proportional to or very closely related to the density of state, this means that most things in a metal, most thermodynamic and transport quantities will also fluctuate, will also oscillate periodically in 1 over B. And this, so each one of these quantities can be used as a probe for this phenomenon. So in particular, and each one of them has been used as a probe for this phenomenon. And what can one see? Well, the first thing that one can detect is the extremal area, this area at which the shells disappear. So it can get geometric properties of the Fermi surface. And other things can be measured from the temperature dependence of this phenomenon, like the cyclotron mass and other properties of the electronic structure. Okay, so this was the story when there was translational invariance. Let's now move to a Hamiltonian which breaks translational invariance, which supports some kind of a charge density wave, which I'm showing here with this potential P. Now the picture is a little bit more complicated, and we can imagine that because this potential here can change the momentum of our wave packet. So we can think that the wave packet that was traveling happily along the Fermi surface gets scattered by the potential across and then travels back like this and gets scattered back. And it completes an orbit which is different than the one we had before. So can we make this picture a little bit more quantitative, a little bit more precise? Yes, we can. We have to just introduce a slightly more complicated wave packet. A wave packet that allows to have a superposition of both momentum k and momentum k plus q. So u and v here are a coefficient that tells you how much momentum is carrying in either of either kind. And we are going to allow u and v, k and r to depend on time, plug into our effect into our action and try to get an effective action. And things simplify dramatically if u and v are depend on time only through p, where p is this combination k minus a that I introduced before. So if you take them to depend only through p and where u of p and v of p are the components of an eigenvalue of this matrix, which involves the potential and the dispersion, then basically the effective action that we get is exactly the same as we had before. It's just that instead of having the dispersion here, we have this eigenvalue here of this matrix. So the PXPY analog particle will travel along constant E contours instead of constant dispersion contours. So what do these constant E contours look like? Well, let me show it here in an example. This is the constant E contour, this thing that I'm drawing in purple. So our wave packet, its coordinate, its PXPY coordinate, will want to travel around this smaller pocket. And Landau levels will be given by those energies at which this thing contains an integer multiple of 2 pi nb, and things will carry through. So what happened to our initial intuitive picture of the wave packet being scattered across the Fermi surface? Well, this is realized by a drastic change of these coefficients, U, F, B, or U and V, as you change side of the pocket. So on this side of the pocket, U is 1 and V is 0. And so basically, you can think of the wave packet as having momentum k. But on the other side, V is 1 and U is 0. And so the packet has momentum k plus q. And at the tip of the pocket, there is this rapid transition, which is truly what we were thinking when we were thinking of being scattered around. So this is as far as you can go using semi-classical approach. And it works very, very well. But there are certain phenomena for which you would want to have a more exact analysis. So in particular, what we have neglected is the fact that the potential can scatter the wave packet at multiples of the wave vectors away. And we could, in principle, include all these things into a bigger matrix that we diagonalize, but things become rapidly unwieldy. It's hard to deal with all these states. But more importantly, there's something that just you cannot get in semi-classical theory, which is magnetic breakdown. So what do I mean by that? Well, we know that when there is no charge density wave, the wave packet just travels along the large Fermi surface. And when there is a substantial amount of amplitude on the charge density wave, then instead the wave packet travels around this small pocket. So there's some non-analytic transition at a certain point. So how does that happen? Well, you can think of turning on the CDW as like turning on a small potential barrier here for the wave packet so that it gets reflected back. But if this potential barrier is sufficiently small, then the wave packet can actually quantum tunnel through it and keep going along its large Fermi surface. And this quantum tunneling phenomenon is really hard to deal with in any other way than an exact treatment. If you want to know exactly what is the probability for this thing to go through, it's a difficult thing to do semi-classically. So how can we solve this problem exactly? Well, we would like to use this the general formula for the density of states and just do some exact diagonalization if you want. But we have to do this inversion here, and it's rather difficult. So we can still pull this trick off, but we have to be careful about how we set up the system. So first of all, we have to set up the system on a cylinder. We can't do a torus because otherwise we would not be able to vary the magnetic field continuously, and because it will be quantized. And if we then choose the indexing of our sparse matrix that represent the single particle Hamiltonian on this cylinder, if we choose the indexing appropriately, then we can give the matrix this block three diagonal form, where the diagonal blocks are just the matrix elements of H within every ring, and the T blocks are the matrix elements of H between a ring and the next ring. And a matrix that has this form, its inverse, we can get the diagonal elements of the inverse of a matrix that has this form, with a complexity that scales linearly with the length of the cylinder. So typically, inversion is an n cube operation. So it means that we should scale with the cube of the length of the cylinder. But because of the specific form, we can get the diagonal elements and therefore the trace only with just linear complexity. And this allows us to go to really large length of the cylinder. And this means that we, first of all, can completely ignore the fact that we have open boundary conditions over here because the cylinder is just so long. And secondly, it means that the density of states is almost that of a continuous system. And we have so many states that you really have to choose a really small regulator eta in order to see every single state. And this large cylinder can host either commensurate or incommensurate CDW, where it has to be commensurate on the radius of the cylinder, but a commensuration period of 50 is roughly like incommensurate. And so this is a perfect setup for studying this the CDW that is realizing cuprates. So this is the approach that I'm going to follow for the next few slides. I'm going to first do some semi-classical analysis to gain some intuition on what is going to happen. And then I'll show you what an exact computation of the quantum oscillation looks like in the same setup. Yep.
So your variational analysis gave you some parameters, and that's contained in this Hamiltonian H.
No, I mean, I think we should think of those two computations as decoupled.
Because then that
talking about the variation, the first part of the talk.
The first part of the talk.
Yes.
Where you have good similar projection.
Yeah.
So there it's not obvious that you have coherent quasi particles as excitations.
That is absolutely correct. Like this is a model of free fermions. There are no interaction effects on this. And yeah, it relies on the assumption that the motion of quasi-particles around the pockets is not affected by interaction. Obviously, those are phenomena that one would want to include, but I don't know of any technique that will allow you to compute quantum oscillations in a fully interacting framework. So.
But you input your variational analysis in this through H?
No, I'm taking a more phenomenological approach where I take all parameters from experiments. I try to be as close as possible to the experimental situation and then see what I can say about oscillation. And by experiments, I mean spectroscopy, basically. Try to fix things. So before I delve into a description of what comes out of this analysis, let me just remind you, okay, this is the kind of CTW that we want to put. It's slightly different than the one I had at the beginning. It's just the fact that I'm taking an equal amplitude superposition of a CDW with wave vector along the x direction and the y direction. So this is called a checkerboard charge density wave, whereas the one with only one wave vector that I was showing before is what's called a stripe CDW. So, but later on I will discuss how much of this assumption that I'm making is reasonable and it's actually necessary for the conclusion that I will draw. I do this, first of all, because this is the only thing that can really match well with quantum oscillation experiments. As purely stripe-like order is really hard to match onto what's in oscillation. So that oscillation, in a sense, are an experiment that tells you that this is probably what's happening. And the other reason is that it's not clear which one of the two is realizing experiment. You know, it's not clear if it's an equal amplitude superposition of the two or if there are like patches of one stripe and the other stripe. So, So what happens here? I'm showing in black the original Fermi surface without any CDW, and then I turn on this checkerboard charge density wave. And in the background, I'm showing the electron spectral function in the presence of the CDW. So you can see that the CDW open up gaps at the points, these points that I'm showing in orange, that are nested by the wave vector. And this opening up of gaps creates these pockets here, this round pocket, and a square pocket that is composed of these four edges here. So I can think of my wave packet as traveling and then being scattered and traveling and being scattered and so on. This reconstruction scheme was first proposed by Harrison and Sebastian in 2011. And what I'm showing here are the zeros of the eigenvalues of that eigenvalue equation that I described before. So these are the pockets that one would get from a semi-classical analysis of this problem. And one thing that I would like to point out is that although our original Fermi surface was a Fermi surface of holes, this pocket here, this red pocket, is a pocket whose excitation carry the opposite charge, are negatively charged excitations. So how do I see that? Well, a simple way of seeing that is thinking about our wave packet going around cyclotron motion on the original Fermi surface in, say, a counterclockwise fashion like this. Now, let's turn on the CDW. Our wave packet still wants to go counterclockwise, but gets scattered here, and then goes counterclockwise, gets scattered, and so on. And if you notice, I went around the red pocket in the opposite fashion. I went around the pocket clockwise by means of all these scattering mechanisms. So it means that the wave packet that goes around this red pocket carries the opposite charge because it goes around in cyclotron motion in the opposite direction. Whereas these blue pockets here are just whole. I have a whole like excitation, positively charged. And why is this thing that I said important? Because if you remember this transport experiment where we saw this change of sign of the transport coefficient as you lower the temperature, where it can be explained here very directly, because as you lower the temperature, these charge correlations condense or at least develop some order. And therefore, we have reconstruction from a Fermi surface of a hole-like excitation to a pocket of electron-like excitation that can give you a negative Hall coefficient, yes?
But what happens to this if you turn off the field?
This is in zero field. This is just...
You know, but the Fermi surface of the cubewrights in zero field is known.
Well, okay, depends on... Well, this is the... Oscillations are typically done in YMBCO, so it's not exactly clear what the Fermi surface
okay.
of YMBCO is.
No. It's a zero field with a very enhanced charge density of order by hand. But if, presumably, the experiment, the enhancing the charge density of order happens in a, because of the field. Here, we just by hand put in a large charge density.
So my main criticism of the Suchitra proposal over the years has been that it depends on a Fermi surface at zero field, which is known not to exist. Well, I have some difficulty.
Why does it depend?
Because we know what the zero field Fermi surface looks like.
You may look, as measured in photo emission above TC.
Yeah.
He's coming for that. I think you're coming for that.
Okay.
Okay, I'm not sure I'm coming to that.
Well, the problem is that the Fermi surface at zero field does not look like that.
In YBCO, you know the shape of the Fermi surface.
You know, it's known for four cubewrights, and in the four where it's known, it does not look like that.
Is referring to the
best numbers in YBCO don't look like that.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Potassium
don't
look nothing like that.
Are you referring to like pseudo gap things and the Fermi arcs and the fact that
I'm just trying to understand which piece of the phase diagram does this thing represent?
This thing is that. Okay, it represents the underdog regime in the absence of any other features except the charge density wave. So there is no pseudo-gap physics, there is no superconductivity, there is, none of the other physics. We are just focusing on that aspect.
Theoretically, by hand, with an enhanced charge density wave.
And a long-range order?
Long-range, perfect, bidirectional.
Yeah.
So it doesn't correspond to any experiment yet.
Yeah. Okay, so we have this picture here, and what do the quantum oscillations look like in this setup? And here I'm showing them. This is the density of states at the Fermi level as a function of the reciprocal of the magnetic field. And we have two sets of periodic oscillations which are marked by red and blue bands, and they correspond to the red and blue pockets. So what I mean is that the frequency matches onto the area of each one of them. So this has been computed semi-classically, and this is an exact computation, and we see that they match into each other exactly. So this is very nice. What can we do with this setup? Well, one thing that we can do is to study the doping dependence of oscillation frequency. We can vary the doping, and the geometry of the Fermi surface will change, but this will also affect the wave vector Q of nesting. We can take the wave vector Q as a function of doping from experiment and see what we can predict about the frequency of oscillation. And this is what we have done. These red dots are the frequency of oscillation of due to the electron pocket as a function of doping. And these dots are experimental data from a collection of different papers. And we see that there is reasonably good agreement. What this plot is not showing is the oscillations coming from the Hall pocket, which is much smaller. So they are down here. And let me say that although there is no experimental backing for the existence of this pocket, this is a rather natural consequence of this model. So either it's not been seen because the frequency is so low that you need to go to too high magnetic field to see it, or maybe it's killed by some nodal, by some anti-nodal physics, some pseudo-gap physics, or maybe it's just there. Yeah, we want to be rather agnostic. It's just it's really hard to get rid of it, so maybe it's there. Okay, so this is nice. Let me move to the last detail I want to discuss is this question of like, what happens or why did I choose to, yep.
But was there some key element of the deform factor which was necessary to produce your
The point? Deform factor doesn't play a very strong role here, yeah, no. Actually, if you play with the form factor, for factors, and you sort of cheat, you can make the whole pocket disappear by means of like, choosing a suitably chosen form factor, but that's okay. So, yeah.
Is there any kind of Lepsius theorem that guarantees that
There would be a Lattice theorem if the CDW was commensurate, but here it's incommensurate, so the size of the Brillouin zone is just zero. If you, the size of the reconstructed Brillouin zone is just zero, so there is no theorem, I think, here. Yeah. Okay, so it seems that this reconstruction scheme depends strongly on the fact that we had a checkerboard charge density wave. But how strongly does it truly rely on it? What happens if we move to a more stripe-like charge density wave like this one? This is what I'm going to show you in this last part of the talk. So here is a semi-classical analysis of this situation. Here on the left, we have just pure stripe-like order. We see that there's these two gaps that have been opened by the charge density wave, and they form this large hole pocket and nothing else. And then if I turn on a little bit of amplitude on the second wave vector, I will open up some gaps here and here and here, and I end up in this picture here where all this, where I already start to see the setup that I was describing before. So I see an electron-like pocket with a small gap that just opened up and two hole-like pockets here and here, which then develop into this fully formed picture in the completely symmetric checkerboard case.
Top right picture is for two charge density wave with
much larger amplitude in the x direction as opposed to the y direction. I don't think you said that.
Okay.
Okay. So what do quantum oscillation looks like in this setup? So this is a This slide may look a little daunting with all these bars, but I'll walk you through it, and it's the last step, and then we are done. So here I'm showing the Fourier transform of the density of states at the Fermi level. And so this means that every peak here corresponds to a frequency. And I can translate that frequency into an area over the Brillouin zone. So, for example, this diagram, which corresponds to this setup here of the purely stripe-like charge density wave, this peak here corresponds to an area of roughly 4% of the Brillouin zone, which is exactly the area given by this pocket. Then I turn on a little bit of amplitude on the second wave vector, and these oscillations coming from this pocket completely disappear. And instead, I see features coming from each one of these three pockets. So each color matches onto the corresponding pocket. I have two frequencies, red, blue, and green, which correspond to these two pockets, which now are inequivalent because there is no symmetry relating them, because the CDW doesn't have the same amplitude on both wave vectors. And then I can also see higher harmonics of them. So these other peaks are just twice as much and three times as much as the original frequency down here. And then there is this red peak associated with the electron pocket here. And then nothing else much changes as you approach the fully symmetric checkerboard case. Just these two pockets become more and more equivalent, so the frequency difference between them decreases until they coalesce into one single frequency because they are identical at the symmetric point. Whereas the electron pocket roughly stays put where it is. And so the main point of this analysis is to show that the presence of the of oscillations coming from this electron pocket does not rely very much on the assumption that the order was checkerboard. It's rather robust. You really have to go to a purely stripe-like order in order to kill this phenomenon and get something else which doesn't have any experimental backing. There is another feature that I would like to describe, which is this orange peak here, which apparently doesn't have any relation with anything that you see here. And this is one of those processes that cannot be captured by a semi-classical analysis. It starts to appear as soon as you turn on a little bit of amplitude and then disappears afterwards. So in order to show where this thing comes from, let me show you the electron spectral, a close-up of this area involving these two pockets here in the electron spectral function. So this gap here, this gap here is just open. I just turn a little bit of amplitude on the second wave vector, and so this is a very small gap. This makes the wave packet go here and get reflected back and then complete the orbit of this electron pocket. And the same is true for the whole pocket. But the potential barrier that we have here is really small, so we can have magnetic breakdown. So what can happen is that the wave packet can come here, and instead of being reflected, can quantum tunnel and then go around here and come back. It can go through a sort of a figure eight kind of pattern like this. And this is a perfectly well-defined orbit, and it should have its own oscillations. But in order to figure out what area it has, we have to notice that the wave packet is going around each one of them in the opposite way. This is, goes back to the fact that one is hole-like and the other is, one is electron-like and the other is hole-like. So truly the area that gives the oscillations is the difference between these two areas. And once you figure out this, which took me a couple of weeks, then you see that this peak actually matches exactly. So this frequency is exactly the frequency of the red peak minus the frequency of the blue peak. And its amplitude is completely beyond what a semi-classical computation can get. It's just due to this quantum mechanical tunneling phenomenon. It can only be gotten through this, exact computation. So this brings me to the end of my talk. I hope I convinced you that we understand relatively well where this charge density wave comes from and many of its experimental signature implication, and in particular in quantum oscillations. And with this, I'd like to conclude and welcome any question if you may have one.
No.
No. So if you measure the spin solubility, so it will decrease or remains unchanged.
If I measure, if I what? Excuse
so
me.
So the spin solubility.
Mm-hmm.
So it will. So when the speed up order develops, does the spin solubility increase or decrease or remain unchanged?
Yeah, no, I don't know the answer to this question.
Because usually sort of gap is identified as the speak people believe there's a spin gap in the sort of gap phase. So I don't know whether this theory can describe the such kind of spin gap.
Well, but I'm not sure. Like, I don't think I ever dealt with the pseudo gap in this. In this, like, the pseudo gap physics here did not appear. We are studying like zero temperature properties of them, or very low temperature properties of that. And so, I didn't attempt to explain pseudo gap physics at any point. In any case,
but can you study finite temperature effects?
Regarding quantum part. Oscillations or
the first part, for example,
or no, doing finite temperature variation of Monte Carlo is impossible. I'm not gonna say impossible, but I don't think anyone knows how to do it. Let's just stay with that.
There is work by De Bonjean on our paper, but mentioned that.
Okay. Yeah. So we have some study of the pseudo gap physics we're using the perturbative methods in field theory, like nothing numerical, nothing like that, and starting from the O6 model, I didn't review any of that. It would take an entire other talk to describe like what we are doing there.
See, if you follow the semi-classical dynamics,
yes.
During one period, the question is how coherent is a quasi-body? If you look at R-phase line widths, look at some kind of average over the Fermi surface in relevant regions, it's very broad. So that's one of the puzzles in this field. That is, there are lots of, there are descriptions in terms of quasi-body. But electron as a quasi particle seems very well ill-defined. So what is your?
Well, this is a problem that has to do with like what's making the quasi particle broad,
exactly.
And that's beyond what we have been doing here. I would assume that this effect is is more important for the hole pockets, the little blue pockets that I was showing, which are closer to the antinode, where all these phenomena are more relevant, whereas the electron pocket is rather close to the node where there's less effects coming from interaction. So it may be protected by that, but that's definitely beyond what we have been doing here, thinking about interactions beyond.
In the high field experiment, there's a lot of excellent evidence that the quasi bodies are perfectly well defined.
Correct. But you know, then you want to compare it with our base, where the electron quasi particles are solely defined.
Yeah. Well,
so how do you.
But I think his answer is right. Near the node, both photo emission.
But you have to go well beyond the node in concept.
No, but it's the little pocket that he's depending on is right at the node.
He has this.
The red pocket is at the node.
Yeah, the little red, yeah. The little
this is not
Harrison Sebastian pocket, let's say, is right at the node.
And the quantum oscillations are the node temperature where there's less and less scattering.
Well, I had a question. So in the semi-classical scheme, does it keep the coherence factors of the D form factor density wave, or does it?
Yes, no. It
keeps the coherence factors in the phase.
No, I'm not sure what you're asking.
So suppose the deform factor density wave was a Pyrrhus mean field density wave, okay? So that it reorders the states above and below the chemical potential. Then the new eigenstates have their own coherence factors, which contain the phase information from the deform factor.
Okay.
And,
well, I think so if you go back to the U's and V's, the
yeah.
matrix.
Yeah.
So the P is...
Okay, in this example, P and I wrote is just S wave, but in the actual computation I make it's D wave. Like it contains all the features of it. It's just that in here P would get a dependence on momentum. It's a slight I just took it off because for the sake of clarity of what
fine,
I was saying.
But when you diagonalize the finite,
yes, I do. Yeah. Otherwise, it would not match with other things.
If you go back to a variation theory, there was a question from CMS about condensation energy, where is it? So can you measure S dot S as well as kinetic energy on various bonds and plot it? Because if there is a modulation of super exchange.
I, in principle, could measure, all expectations.
Because then, it would say whether it's some kind of hidden balance bond order.
Yeah. To answer the question of what's driving what's driving the energetics of this, maybe it's better to look at the expectation value of the operator.
The kinetic energy.
Yeah, but I tried to do that, but there's a little bit too much noise to draw any substantial conclusion. Like it's,
That's a very good question. Can I say again what I said earlier? So in real solid state physics, the nuclei get moved. That's where the energy saving comes from, right? That's where the textbook energy saving
in boring solid state physics.
In real solid state physics, the nuclei get moved. Okay.
But it seems like what you really needed was a large V. So maybe people keep mentioning kinetic energy and super exchange. What about V?
Well, what I needed was a large V in order to stabilize as compared to the Stagger flux state. Truly, like if you suppress this state here, then this goes down all the way to J equals zero, to solid, all the way down to V equals zero.
Well, yeah.
If you suppress the Stagger flux, then this phase is stable compared to this one all the way
uh-huh.
to J.
But still, V encourages this thing very strongly.
Yeah, V encourages the CDW as compared to the Stagger flux.
And also.
Competition between the two vectors seems to be driven mostly by J, actually. You know, large J prefers this one, small J prefers that one. The boundary between the two is rather vertical.
All right, I think we should close the talk because of another talk. 4:30. All right, any more questions?